Facing challenges and overcoming setbacks is part of doing business. Whether you have the expertise to survive them or not could mean the difference between success or failure. Welcome to We Are Women, featuring revealing conversations that provide invaluable insights into the success secrets of female masterminds. A must listen for every entrepreneurial woman. Now here's your host, Janine Vosper.
Hi, it's Janine Vosper here, and welcome to this episode of the We Are Women podcast. Today, I have Bronwyn Williams. Now, in 2012, while working with asylum seekers on Nauru, Bronwyn came face to face with her own biases of racism and white superiority. Now, as the bias expert, she's based in Melbourne and working worldwide, Bronwyn works with boards and teams and individuals to build awareness around bias in company culture, in leadership and management and staff welfare. Together, they identify the biases that are, I'm going to say, biases, a little bit of slip there of S's, isn't it? Together, they identify the bias that are limiting productivity and develop bespoke strategies to increase profitability. Welcome, Bronwyn. This is such a fascinating subject. I know when we met the other day and chatting, I've gone, this is really interesting stuff because you don't realize you're doing it.
That's right. That's why they call it unconscious bias and why my motto is to make bias conscious so that we become aware of it, because what we don't see, we can't work with.
And it's interesting, since our initial conversation, I have been consciously aware of where I've had a bias on, and certain things just pop up, and we'll get into those as well. But I was really amazed, you know, I see someone walking along the street and I've already made a judgment call on that person. Yeah. And then it puts you in a state of not fear, but concern, apprehension, caution, whatever it may be as well, because of that initial just assumption you jumped to. But tell me about being on Nauru and your past experiences. We want to get to know you a little bit, Bronwyn.
Okay. Well, my professional background is as a teacher, but in midlife, I had, you know, the traditional midlife crisis after, you know, changing my personal circumstances. And I joined the Salvation Army and trained with them as a Salvation Army officer. And as part of that, in 2012, when the federal government reopened offshore processing on Nauru and Manus Island, the Salvation Army were given the contract to provide the welfare services. And an email went around to all staff and officers looking for volunteers to go for 4 weeks to just be part of the cohort over there. Now, I didn't have this burning desire to work with refugees. I didn't have a burning desire to work in the tropics. I've always lived in the southern parts of Australia, so heat was not necessarily something that I was seeking. But I put my hand up because I couldn't think of any reason why not to. And we talk about life-changing situations. And I know that's cliched, but this literally changed the course and the trajectory for my life. So we'd been up for about 24 hours. We'd caught the red eye from Brisbane in the middle of the night, bumped down into Honiara to refuel in the Solomon Islands. And then by sort of early to mid-morning, we're all walking down the stairs of the plane onto the pretty hot tarmac at Nauru Airport there. And I'm inching my way through to the customs and immigration, which, like on a tropical island, was very laid back, wasn't fast. You know, it was sort of like, okay, welcome to Nauru time. And we went on to then have a full day's orientation. So by the end of that day, we'd been up for over 24 hours, you know, because you can't actually sleep on a plane. And the last thing to do was to go down into the camp and see where we were going to be working then for the next 4 weeks. And we went down in small groups led by one of the experienced volunteers. And as I walked around with my group, I felt this sort of stirring, a rumbling underneath my ribs in the pit of my stomach. I didn't really know what it was, but over the next few days, as I reflected on that, I realized that that physical reaction, a bit like what you were talking about, was there was actually some fear there. And it wasn't because and they were all men in the camp at this stage, wasn't that the men were actually able to do anything to me. You know, they were just sitting around on chairs. They were disoriented. It was hot. So I wasn't in any physical danger. But what I realized was I was afraid because these men were a different skin color, a different race. They spoke languages that I didn't understand. And I knew most of them were Muslim. And I'd grown up in the sort of Christian faith tradition. And as I thought about that a bit more, I realized that for a woman who would have said she didn't have a racist bone in her body, I actually had this latent racism, just purely from having been brought up in a white monocultural area of Sydney, where I'd really had very little to do with people of other nations. And I found that quite appalling because that didn't fit with how I saw myself. And then I went back a second time as a volunteer. So that first time I used my teaching skills. I was in the classroom teaching basic English. Second time I went back as just in an administrative role for 3 weeks. And it was during that time that I realised I needed to be working here, that this, you know, we talk about destiny, but that's what I just knew. I needed to be there full time. And so I asked the Salvation Army for a change of appointment. And in June of 2013, I went back in a full-time role as the religious liaison officer. And my role there was to make sure that the religious needs of the asylum seekers were met. So that meant putting in orders that would then be sourced by one of the other providers on the island for things like Quran materials, whether they were commentaries or Qurans, because Qurans are only written in Arabic, but yeah. You can get a commentary in a variety of different languages, or, you know, information for Hindus. We had a variety of different Christians, like we had Tamil Christians. So we were looking for Bibles in Tamil and Sinhalese. We were looking for Bibles in other languages as well, like Vietnamese, because there were Catholics from Vietnam on the island. Buddhists, even Zoroastrian, which is a very old Middle Eastern religion, and their religious materials are called Avesta. Now, didn't know anything about that.
Wow.
But I know. So had to source those because we recognised that when people's religious needs were being met, their mental health was likely to be better.
And that's something that, you know, from the outside, without knowing, it would not be something that you would even think that was important or something that would be catered for. But it certainly is incredibly important for people to be able to practice their faith and in a place that makes people know that there's something continuous in their life, isn't it? That's something very real.
Something very real. And I like the idea of that continuity, because for these people, and by the time I went back as the religious liaison officer, there were families, couples, children also there. So their lives had been hugely disrupted, first of all, because they'd fled whichever country they came from, because they were either being persecuted or they feared being persecuted. And then all of them had got on a leaky boat and made it their way to Australia. Now, when you look at the size of some of those boats and the condition of some of those boats, that is a huge undertaking. They had scraped together the money to pay the people smugglers. So we're not talking about people who have enormous riches in their own country, but, you know, parents, extended family have taken out loans. so that they can escape. Just huge sacrifices that they'd already made, and for often for them.
It's always fascinated me that anyone that moves from one country to another has fascinated me. And I think being an Australian, that's just because, you know, you feel so blessed being here and not always thinking about where you need to be. Somewhere is going to be better. And I've read a lot of stories about the Syrian refugees going out across Europe and family sponsoring them and the difficulties and the boats and drownings and things like that. So it's a big step to get there. But so when you first arrived that first time, you know, you said the pit of the stomach, fear feeling, then going back and working in the community, how did that change for you?
Well, the second thing that I discovered about myself, which I almost observed in the other expats who were working there, was this sense of superiority. Because, hello, you know, we were from a developed country. Nauru was this little tiny island where a lot of the people had never been off it. Many of us were university educated. And I sat down with Fatima, who was the leader of the Nauruan team working with the Salvation Army, and said, look, this is what I've observed. And she said, oh, we know that about you people, but we just accept that. Now, I could have died on the spot. Again, this did not fit with how I saw myself.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things about working in the community there was, and it really plays into bias, I had the opportunity, because I was a minister of religion, and Nauru has like 80% of people are Christians. They have a really strong Christian heritage there. So I had, just by nature of my position, respect in the community. And a group of pastors from the island asked me to come while they talked through some of their concerns. And this was before the family groups had come. And of course, because so many of the men were Muslim, there was real concern that there were all these Muslims coming to a Christian island. But one of the things that was just so pertinent about our biases and the quick judgments that we make. Now, if a Muslim person is introduced to you, they will shake hands, but then they often put their hand to their chest, or to their heart. Now, that's a traditional way. There's a sense in which they're saying, my heart to your heart. You know, it's a sign of respect. One of the Nauruan pastors interpreted that the Muslim man had shaken hands and then was wiping the contact off on his chest.
Right.
And I thought, I understood why that was the case, because that might be, you know, we might, you know, do that sort of thing. Mm. But that was totally misinterpreting what was actually happening from a Muslim perspective there.
That's really interesting, isn't it? And I suppose when you've had the opportunity to travel to a lot of Muslim countries, then you have, or any countries that have different colour, different religion, totally different, you know, beliefs and value systems, then you a bit more open to recognizing that things are done differently. But for the Nauruans, is that correct? Are they called Nauruans?
That's correct. Yes, that's right.
For the Nauruans, that's, they possibly haven't been open to experiencing that in the past and not aware of, okay, oh, that's actually a tribute as opposed to, yes.
Disrespect.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And you find, and because of, you know, the way TV plays out and play, it just gives us all these misinterpretations of people from different faiths, then, you know, and it's a very small minority as opposed to the general population. Mm. It's a surprise, isn't it? I'm just thinking, and I'll go back to that in a minute. I'm just thinking, I was used to attend a ladies-only gym, so we'd have a lot of Muslim ladies come in because they can attend the gym. And so after the morning workouts, they'd get dressed and they would put their hijab on and, you know, we'd sit down and have breakfast and everything. And we're all chatting about the same thing, about trying to get the kids to school. And it was all the same conversation. It was
absolutely,
and they just wore a hijab instead of, I'm pronouncing that correctly, aren't I? Yes.
Yes, you are. Yeah.
Instead of, you know, racing out of the gym in their joggers, and it was, but it was, I found that a really big learning curve for me, because everyone's, we just got the same stuff going on.
And we do. People are people.
Yeah. And I ended up having an Indian gentleman who was a Muslim as my PE trainer, and he was brilliant.
Okay.
He just, loved working with him and inquiring as well to the different ways of his faith and going back to India to get married. And because he was a Muslim in India, he was a minority, and there was issues about his wife coming back here and things. But yeah, it was, I personally, and I know I have definitely have biases, we all do, but I love that inquiring about different things, because it just opens you up to that experience a little bit more.
It certainly does. And I know, because I'd had that initial understanding around my own racism before I went back full time, I know I was then much better able to do my job as the religious liaison officer, because like I worked for a Christian organisation, but I was not allowed to privilege Christians over anybody else in the cohort. That was such a fantastic thing for me to do, because I had to actually struggle that with other people in the Salvation Army who saw that my role should be just, you know, catering to the Christians, but our brief from the government was not. And I found that I learnt so much. One of the good things that the Salvation Army did during that time was they employed often refugees from Australia, or refugees who lived in Australia, not refugees from Australia trying to escape Australia.
That would be a small boat.
It would be a small boat, wouldn't it? Oh, yeah. But look, we had people on our team who were Hindu and Buddhist and Muslim. We had people who had grown up in refugee camps in Africa, in Ghana and the Sudan. We had people from Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan, Pakistan, Vietnam, Sri Lanka, all of these people on our team. So there was all these beautiful languages floating around me in the staff room, and where my desk was, I was right in the middle of the Nauruan team. So, you know, the Nauruan men are all there talking away around themselves. But if they wanted to talk to me, they spoke English. So I never had this sense of being excluded. They didn't exclude me because they spoke other languages. If they wanted to talk to each other, they used their own language, wanted to talk to me, they spoke in English because that's the only one I know. But it was just this wonderful sense of understanding what we had in common, just like you did with your ladies at the gym. And I discovered that people of faith, didn't matter what your faith was, actually understood people of faith, because we all have this idea of transcendence, something bigger than ourselves, a sense of purpose. And I particularly remember one very dark-skinned, big man from Ghana who was a Muslim. And I just I learnt so much from him being on our team. We would often have staff meetings towards the end of the day, around 5 o'clock. And of course, that's one of the Muslim prayer times. Now, this man, and unfortunately, I can't remember his name, though his face is like indelibly printed on my brain. He would come into the staff meeting, duck down behind the desks, and then half the time you wouldn't even know, see him do that. You'd only know that he finished his prayers because he'd pop up again. So he just took his faith into the staff room, did his own ritual, which was important to him, but in such an unobtrusive way that most of us didn't even know he was doing it.
So he
fitted his faith in around things. And I just found that experience broadened my perspective hugely. Mm.
Yes. And look, being a woman going into that situation, was there biases from the men particularly that you worked with that of your role as their leader?
Yeah, that's really interesting because I think we make assumptions about Muslim men, particularly around their attitude to women. I did not find different. One piece of disrespect or if anything, it was the white Aussies who were more disrespectful, male and female, than any of the Muslims in the crew. And getting to know some of the asylum seekers and hear them talk about their mothers, particularly me being an older woman and my hair was grey at that time, put me into that older woman category, which was very much revered by Muslim men.
And there's there's a lot of cultures that call that auntie, isn't it? Yeah. A lot of Polynesian cultures, the auntie has the most control over the whole family and that respectful position. Now, I've always found that with my travels as well that, you know, the older you get, the more respect. I travel with a friend regularly and she's 12 years older than me and so she's in her 70s and she just gets so much respect from everybody, and even though she's fit and agile and can do everything, that they really do, wherever we go, the Asian countries particularly, they honor her, which is wonderful. But we get those biases here against women, as you said. It's and the workplace, I know that glass ceiling is something we talk about all the time, isn't it?
It is, and I just this morning I was reading a post which I reshared on LinkedIn from a man working in the legal profession about two of his female colleagues who are working with him in part of a team, and he was the only one getting the email correspondence, even though he had specifically requested that his two female colleagues get the same communications, and he had requested it a number of times. Still, the other men in the office were excluding the women. So I just thought, goodness me, this is 2020 and it's not, like, biases can be so subtle that we don't notice them, but often they're just plain in your face and people don't seem to care. But because, you know, operating out of bias in a sense gives us a sense of control, that, you know, there's a sense of power about it.
And then it reinforces that, okay, well, that's what I believe. So if I reinforce it continually with that bias, then that affirms that we are right.
Oh, that's right. Yes. And, you know, like there is such a thing too as confirmation bias, where we seek out, and we all do this, we seek out people who think the same way as we do. But not only that, we seek confirmation that our interpretation of a situation is right because it's the same as ours.
And I know when my sons are in their 30s and all of their friends are as well, but when they were in their 20s, it was often heard, you know, about these lazy 20-year-olds that, didn't work as hard as their parents did. And I'd go, well, I don't know any. You know, I know lots of 20-plus-year-olds and I do not know a single one of them that's lazy and bludging off their family. Everyone I know is either earning or learning. And people would just be, oh, okay. You know, and I wasn't going to confirm that bias. That, and it's the same with a lot of racist. I have got some friends that what comes out of their mouth when it comes to racism, I just have to, you know, zip it up or say, I don't know, I haven't seen that, or, you know, but definitely not confirm. And it's such a small part of the friendship that I let that pass and challenge gently on that by going, I don't agree. But it's just so easy to slot people into a particular space, isn't it?
And category.
Yeah, that's category. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, I remember many years ago now, I had a friend who's probably about 10 years older than me, so their children are 10 years older than mine. She commented to me that her daughter, who at that stage was 26, she said, she just doesn't seem as mature as we were at her age. And I went, really? Because when you're 26, you feel quite mature, thank you very much. And I'm sure that her daughter does too. But I think that's one of our biases, because we look back as we get older and go, well, that person, oh, I was much more mature at that age. Forgetting that actually we weren't, because we were 26 too. You know, people don't get to be more mature at 26 than anybody else because you've only lived 26 years.
Yeah, an interesting comment. I'm wondering in that particular instance, she's thinking she was probably married with children by that time, where, and out of home, whereas a daughter's still living with them. You know, that might be the behaviour was, you know, more different. Grown up or different behaviour. Yeah,
it's different behaviour. Mm. And look, I can see that. Mm. I have three sons and there's 4 years and then 7 years between them. So the youngest, you know, he's 11 years younger than his older brother. But the older two married quite young at 19 and 20 and had their families almost straight away, which means my eldest, by the time he turns 40, his daughter will be nearly 20. You know, he's grown up with his daughter. Mm. Now, I look at them and then I look at my youngest son, who is still in his mid-20s and living the party animal life as much as you can in Sydney, even though the lockdowns and things in COVID are not as serious there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know. It's easy, as you say, to say his older brothers were more mature at his age. They just had more responsibilities that they'd chosen, which does actually change you.
Mm.
But, you know, it's hard to say.
It's that general statement, isn't it? And I suppose age is one, isn't it? Age is one of the biggest biases. Yes. You know, I'm part of a not-for-profit public speaking organisation called Power Talk, and it used to be Toastmistress Clubs in the 1930s. It's changed its brand over the years.
Yeah.
And we had a conference in Brisbane in 2007, and we had, you know, hundreds of delegates from all around the world. And each lunch hour, there was a woman that delivered these most amazing anecdotes, just roll on the floor funny. And she was in the late 80s with a walker. So they'd announce her and she'd walk up with the walker to the stage, and she was brilliant. So the first time I saw her, I went, okay. But amazing. And I did, and that's one of the reasons I stay with the organization, is because I just want to be like her when I grow up. You know, that's what I wanted. And I said to her after one, we're chatting and she was resting, and I said, do you ever think you'll forget what you're going to say? She said, I thought about it one day. I might start writing it down in case I get a bump on the head. You know, that was her perspective of that. But she's hired all around the world to give anecdotes. But if you saw that and saw her, you would be going, no.
No, we make assumptions. There's a wonderful book called Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. And he really started the whole looking at unconscious bias and writing about it. And he talks about, like, thinking fast as those quick judgments we make. Oh, old lady with a walker, therefore, and you add the things. Whereas thinking slow is old lady with a walker. I wonder what she's like. Mm. So, and I loved that analogy that we make so many of our judgments, as you were saying about people that walk towards you on the street, we make a snap judgment. That's thinking fast. We literally do it without thinking. It's an instinct.
And that's part of our survival mode too. I mean, that's innate in us. Is this a dangerous situation? And to make that judgment call to protect ourselves, but we are making a judgment call, and colour of the skin and whether it's a male definitely changes our perspective on that.
It does, unfortunately, because again, we have associated particularly male, and you say a colour of skin, with a particular set of characteristics. Mm. And I know for myself on LinkedIn, I have a preference for, I'm going to work with men, it'll be white men. because that's what I'm used to and I'm comfortable with. And when I get a connection request from somebody, a man from India or another country where skin colour is different, I actually have to, this is where addressing our biases becomes an intentional thing, because my instinctive bias is to go, no. But then I have to do the slow thinking. Rather than just going, no, you can't connect with me, I have to literally stop and go, okay, Bronwyn, why are you doing that? Go and have a look at their profile. Are their skill set, is that somebody you would normally connect with if they were a different skin color? You know, have a look at them and then make the decision. And that for me is where bias and addressing our biases just becomes a whole of life situation, because I don't actually believe we can get rid of our biases, because they form so early in life, they're almost like part of our psychological DNA, but we can choose whether we act on them or not.
Yeah, that's a good statement. I was just thinking about that, whether we can change our biases. In a lot of the public speaking training that I do, particularly in English as second language to a lot of the people, so they come from everywhere, particularly in India and China, that's probably the main nationalities. And so I'm regularly working with people either online or in person who, you know, from natives from those countries who want to speak English better. And I've got very comfortable in their company, like very comfortable. Yeah. So I had an Indian trainer as well. And so it, for me, it's it, again, inquiring, fascinating. Once you've been to India as well, you just know that men hang around you really close, and that's just what happens. It's more because they want to hear the English conversation, I found out, than anything else. So there's all these men sort of going, and it's really interesting. So I just maybe whether you're, because you know your experience in Nauru would have conditioned you differently. And when you're traveling or when you're working with people, that conditions you differently. So maybe you can change those biases a bit, but they're not maybe, again, maybe just not quick enough, as quick to judge. Maybe that's the point.
Yeah, look, I actually think it's, well, like that example that I gave you with, you know, a LinkedIn connection, my initial response comes up. Comes up. And I don't think I can change that particularly, but I can then choose, once I notice that, to go, am I going to act on this or not? And I think that's the whole thing about making bias conscious, is that we start to see it and then we make intentional choices around whether we operate out of that bias or we make a different choice. I often say that my Nauru experience helped me move from seeing difference as a threat to seeing difference as an asset.
Okay.
Now, that's been my journey, but I continue to make that journey all the time, because my instinctive position is to see difference as a threat. I see it much less, but I think it'll be there forever.
Okay.
But I make a choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, like the situation I said about the lawyers. Now, I don't know whether those women are being excluded deliberately or people are just forgetting because they're not being intentional about following through on things that they've been asked to do.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? And I know even things like the body size or, you know, those judgment calls on that as well. Can't that person go on a diet, you know, as soon as whatever it is, or they're eating one chocolate aisle, I can see why they're that size. Or it's that.
Yep. Yeah. We've all done that, haven't we?
Absolutely. Yeah. We hold that in judgment all the time. And I think it's, and particularly, you know, with people who are on TV and in TV shows or TV hosts, and particularly TV hosts and what am I thinking, news announcers, that type of, you know, there's a lot longer life for men on those positions than there are for women. I was watching a show this week, and I can't think what the name of it was, and it was the most unattractive man I have ever seen on TV. And I did. I sat there and gone, I am really amazed that you've got work as an actor, because he was so unattractive. And yeah, it was nearly confronting unattractiveness.
Mm. Wow, okay.
In the role that he was playing, but he was playing an average person. It wasn't playing anyone. It was really interesting. I'm looking at that going, wow, my judgment of somebody in that role is you're looking for those things all the time and looking for the faults. And there was another woman with big ears the other day, and I'm looking for those. You're spotting those faults, and it changes your opinion of that, the character they're playing, and that person as an actor as well.
Yeah. See, what I think is, like, I don't think there's any issues with us being able to notice differences, you know, because we are all different body shapes and sizes and ages and skin colors. But it's when we attribute usually negative characteristics towards that person because they weigh more than we do, or they weigh less than us, or they are older than us or younger than us, or their skin color is different to us. That's where the issue lies, because observation of, you know, skin color and race, you can't hide that. Mm. And I don't think that there's an issue with that. But it's when we say that person is dot, 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 because they are.
Mm.
And yeah. And whether we say that out loud or we just think it to ourselves, you know, yeah, that's the issue.
Yeah. Yes. That is it. That's what goes through the head, isn't it? Mm. So, you know, in a work environment for the women listening that are in business, how do they recognize that they have biases, and how can they, if they have biases against them, like the two lawyers you were talking about, what can they do to help other people see them as who they are and not just looking through the filter?
Yes, I like that idea of a filter, lenses that we look through. Now, it's important. One of the things that I always say is that awareness is more than 50% of the game. So, like, just like you had said, that even since our initial conversation, you have become more aware of your own biases.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had that reflected back to me by other people as well, who said, before I talked with you, I didn't even know I had biases. I wouldn't have said I was biased in any way. And they said, but now that you're starting to talk about it, I can start to see.
Mm.
And I think that's really where we start, is just even acknowledging the possibility that we could be biased. If we do that, then I think because we started to acknowledge that, then our brain does its own unconscious thing and it starts to notice things. It's like that whole thing about, you know, you buy a new car and then all of a sudden you see 1,000 of those cars. Well, those 1,000 cars were already there before, but you weren't aware of them. Yep. And the same it is with...
Yeah, you've activated your reticulated activating system, your RAS. That's what does that.
Your RAS.
Yeah, your RAS.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, maybe biases have a RAS as well.
Oh, everything has a RAS. So something... Yeah. Draws attention. We're getting 32 million bits of information to us every second.
Mm.
And so everything's filtered out until it becomes in our vision, and then our reticulated activating system hones in on that because it's now in our conscious framework. Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah. That's the car one. The car thing is a really good place to,
that's
where most of us can identify that.
It's a good example because most of us understand that. But that's, we can apply that to our biases as well. So I always encourage people to be kind to themselves, because once you become aware of your bias, like I have around white superiority, there are times when I fall back into that because that's my default position. You know, I revert to type. And when I notice it, I go, okay, you've done it again, Bron. But to be kind, because I've, you know, for most of us, we've got decades of looking at life from a through particular lenses, and now we're trying to see the world differently. Mm. So we are going to have moments where we fail ourselves because we've determined we're going to go somewhere different, and then we don't. So yeah, to be kind to ourselves and pick ourselves up and start again on the road that we've decided to go on.
Mm.
You know, I think that's important.
And hidden biases, you know, will play out, I'm assuming, as we're talking about now, but in the workplace, that can be very difficult for people, you know, like these two women, to how do we confront that with others? Is there any suggestions on that?
Look, it's a very difficult situation because those of us who experience bias, and, you know, Indigenous Australians would put their hands up and say, you know, we experience things that people who are white don't.
Mm.
But often people who are white, when we listen to what Indigenous Australians are saying to us, we filter their words through our own experience and we say, well, that hasn't happened to me. Therefore, what are they complaining about? So I think it's actually hard as the person who is on the receiving end of bias to complain, bring it to notice, because often you're then perceived as just being a whinger or a complainer, you know, the noisy wheel as such. But I think this is why I do so much work and my focus area is on boards and executive teams, because any change of culture, any change of thinking must come from the top in an organisation, because you can have people who are, you know, at the lower, for want of a better word, you know, at the lower echelons of the hierarchical structure, who can see things. But if those in leadership can't see them, then nothing changes. And that's why it's really important for our leaders to start owning their biases. And that's why I do the work that I do. I want to make bias conscious in those executive areas, because it'll be better for everybody. You get better decision making, the productivity of the company increases, the profits go up. It's a win-win for everybody.
And that bias, just even I'm thinking in the workplace, you know, there's different components in the workplace. So the executive, you know, their bias against the marketing team who aren't doing their job, or the bias against in the warehousing team, bias against the managers who make their life difficult. Mm. You know, it flows right through, isn't it? Yeah, and it is. That ego, that the superiority, it's a great word. Our job is more important than yours, and so we have priority over you, rather than working in a consultative type of approach in the workplace. Mm. Yeah, I can see that playing out there very much so.
And then look, it's a huge task, and if you continue to look at how big it is, you'd not do anything. But if you don't do something, then things never change.
Mm.
And so, you know, I suppose I've lived longer to know enough that I won't actually probably change the world in my lifetime, but I can do my bit.
Yes, one starfish at a time.
That's right. Well, as my old Sunday school song said, you in your small corner and I in mine. And I like that idea. Just do what you can where you are.
Absolutely. Now, any particular takeaways, like a couple of points that people can take away with them to go out of everything that we've gone through here?
Yeah. First of all, that awareness is more than 50% of the game.
Mm-hmm.
So start to become aware that you could possibly be biased, and then you will start to see it. So that's the first one. The second one is to be kind to yourself. When you notice in yourself that you are falling into decisions based on biases that you determined you were not going to make, be kind to yourself, make the changes that you can, and then just, you know, get on with the job. And I think is to have courageous conversations. You know, you talked about your friends who make racist comments or biased comments, and it is hard to balance. How much do I say because they're my friends? And certainly in the workplace, that's tricky too if you are on the receiving end, particularly from someone in management. But just say what you can within the context. I think that's important as well, so that you don't allow the biases to go unchallenged.
No, and that's actually a topic I teach is courageous conversations. It's because we do have to do them to own within ourselves as well. How can people find out a little bit more about what you do, and is there anything on offer that you've got for anyone, Bronwyn?
Certainly. I have a PDF giveaway around the benefits of working with bias, because it's not just about getting rid of the stuff and it's all negative. There are real benefits around that. So that's a real giveaway there, which I'm sure I'll get you to pop that in the
That'll be in the notes comments. As well. But yeah. Yes, you'll be able to find it at bronwynwilliams.com.
Yes. So bronwilliams.com. Bronwilliams.com.
Bronwilliams.com. And yes, and there'll be a little opt-in thing with that
yes,
PDF.
Yes, there are. Yeah. On every page of my website. So you can't
clever girl. No, I know. I have all these people that it says they've popped up and they've you know, enrolled for my blog, and I've gone, oh yeah, that's what they do when they download my ebook as well. So that's been really interesting conversation, and I say this every time when I have a conversation with somebody, how quickly the time's gone. And I'd love to chat more just off, you know, when we get a chance about Nauru. I'd like to
I'm sure we
will. Yeah, it's certainly an interesting and difficult thing that's going on and constantly going on. And it I know is. That there's an issue with a hotel in Brisbane where these refugees have been in lockdown for a couple of years, and they're just trying to get them allowed to be out to have some go for a walk and outside, and there's protests now, but the protests, I'm not into the protests that hold up streets and things like that at all. But them talking about these protests has made me go, so why are these people still in the hotel? You know, I'm now questioning
What's
that myself.
Point?
Yeah. So yeah. I want to know more about it to find out that if through my social network I can, if it's unjustified that, you know, the mental health on staying. I know people are complaining about their 14 days and they're jumping out of windows, nearly, let alone 2 years stuck in somewhere
like
that. Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, it's not good. Bronwyn, thank you so much for sharing that. And you are the bias expert, which is absolutely wonderful. Really enjoyed the conversation. And if you're looking for anything from Bronwyn, it's bronwilliams.com. Well done.
Correct.
Thank you. And that's another episode of the We Are Women podcast. I've really enjoyed the time with Bronwyn today. If you have enjoyed that as well, please remember to leave a 5-star review. And you can download the ebook that I mentioned at JeaneVosper.com, or check out any of the lots of free blogs and all of the past podcasts as well. There's a ton of stuff on the website. Please do that and invite your friends to subscribe to this podcast and also YouTube and everything else, whether you want to find out more information about how you can think differently and how you can live differently and how you can create a better business by being different yourself. All right. Have a great day. Jeanine Vosper. Bye-bye.
So, do you feel stuck in a rut in business? Visit speechperfect.com.au and download Jeanine's free ebook to avoid the 5 most common stumbling blocks women face in business. It's jam-packed full of tips to overcome the barriers that could be holding you back from the success that you dream your business will be. We would love you to leave a review of today's episode and share this podcast with other women in need of entrepreneurial inspiration. Subscribe to the next episode now and join the We Are Women community.